Welcome back to another episode of Tourism Geography's podcast. My name is Stephen Pratt, and I'm coming to you from the University of Central Florida in Orlando, USA. I'm one of the editors of the journal Tourism Geographies. The journal Tourism Geographies is an international journal of tourism, space, place, and environment. We hope you've been keeping well since the last episode and look forward to learning more about cutting-edge research in tourism and geographies published in the journal. Now let's get to this week's episode. So welcome to this week's Tourism Geographies podcast. I'm fortunate enough to be joined today by Jane Lovell. She's a reader at Canterbury Christchurch University in the UK. Welcome, Jane.
Thank you very much for having me on the podcast. It's very exciting to be here.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you about a very unusual topic, well, from my perspective. You recently published a paper in Tourism Geographies entitled Fairy Tourism, Negotiating the Production of Fantasy Geographies and Magical Storyscapes. So there's a lot to unpack in that title. So just maybe you could just introduce yourself a little bit and explain where did you get the idea for this paper, the motivation for this paper? Thanks.
Okay, well, I suppose I've always been quite interested in fantasy. Ever since I was a young child, I've enjoyed it, spent a large proportion of my young childhood looking for King Arthur in the back garden and local hills. And as an adult, you move on, you become cool, you get into post-punk for me and a new wave, and you leave all that behind. And one of the great pleasures of an academic career is that you can rediscover some of your passions and they can ignite some really meaningful research. So I'm lucky enough to work with my very esteemed colleague, Natasha Sharma, on this paper. And Natasha's a super brain on all things religious, dark tourism related. And we were both fascinated by the topic and loved reading about fairies and rediscovering these childhood passions. And we began to look at how in this day and age would you actually recreate fairyland? In what way do you do it? Because fairyland is what we call a liminal or in-between concept. It's really nebulous. And magic itself is a nebulous idea. You can't pin it down. It's elusive, but it's also, and I love this word, fugitive. So it actually runs away from you the closer you try to get to it. So we were really interested in tourism development and how do the producers of tourism actually start to pin it down a bit and concretize it. And obviously, if you're trying to create a fairy-based visitor attraction, and there are lots out there, if you start looking, they are absolutely everywhere. Ireland and the Celtic nations have a lot of fairy forts, but also there are many in Asia, there are many fairy folk attractions in the far north of Europe, and you can see sort of commonalities globally. So it came from our passion for exploring things that are fantasy related. And the real basic idea behind it was, what are the liminal qualities of fairy festivals, which we centered on as our primary visitor attraction here, as storyscapes? Because you're trying to build a lovely narrative world for people to inhabit and encounter. So we started with that. Sorry, I'm rambling on a little bit here. If there's another question you'd like to ask, please do interject, because it's a subject I just love.
Sure. So what happens at fairy festivals? I've never been one to myself, but if readers and listeners read about fairy festivals, what sort of events or attractions or, things to do? What do you do at a fairy festival?
Well, the wonderful thing about fairy festivals is, like many fairy attractions, they hide in plain sight. So until you start researching anything fairy related, you don't realise they're everywhere. So many forests or rural visitor attractions have a fairy trail within them for children. These are little mini doors in trees. And often you have a fairy kitchen and toadstool attractions. So these are everywhere. And then fairy festivals take this concept of gathering, people gathering to celebrate the fairy world and really encounter some approximation of fairy land. And people just about do everything there. So they dress up primarily. So there's a lot of cosplay that happens. And in fact, one of our participants objected to the word cosplay. She said, it's not, we're inhabiting the role. It's not play. We are the person for that time. So it's about identity. But also, what was fascinating about this research was that there were commonalities between the different festivals. So most of them had, what people did there was they did this activity called wish granting. And one festival had a wishing line. So you post your wishes, and this dates back to an ancient folkloric custom of a clootie tree, and you post your wishes on this wishing line and ask for the fairies to grant them. And these wishes were actually very profound, and some were incredibly moving. And it was amazing that all of the festivals had this tradition in different ways, shapes, and forms, although they hadn't actually spoken to each other. It was sort of an organic movement. And some would actually burn the wishes. There was one festival that placed them in a wicker wolf or symbolic animal and would burn this animal. So you've got that sort of activity. There are a lot of workshops where you can do things like wreath making or understanding the magical properties of trees or flowers. And they also, these festivals included, I would say, other different fantasy subcultures. And so mixed up quite a lot. And this was one of the extraordinary things. It's a bit early to talk about takeaways, but this is one of the extraordinary things we found, that they mixed Wicca practices with some quite serious neo-pagan and alternative believers with lighter, what we would call in tourism, transmedia. That means media on different platforms. Transmedia fantasy interests. So you'd have an orc boot camp and then you'd have a fairy activity next door. So there were loads of different activities and rituals.
Right. So it's, I mean, it's quite a spectrum.
Yes, it is. Absolutely. And what was amazing was that you might have thought these different tribes perhaps wouldn't mix, and that possibly there's an element of being a practicing neo-pagan that differentiates you. But at these festivals, people seem to recognize they have more in common than they had differently. And it was a place, one of the things they had in common was something called magical thinking, where you reach out to encounter a sympathetic force in magic and perhaps ask it to heal, or perhaps it to you want it to use the magic for different reasons.
Now, I see in the paper that you've used this concept of liminal affective technologies. Can you unpack that concept for
Yes, of
the
course.
listeners?
Yes, I think we'd want to start with liminal affectivity, which was originated by Stenner and Greco. And thank you so much, Stenner and Greco. We really do stand on the shoulders of giants, don't we, when we research. This is an anthropological term, and it's about the fact that you're creating a feeling of proximity to the otherworldly, but you also have material versions of it. And these liminal affective technologies include, well, they're designed to evoke moods. Liminal means in between, and they evoke these wonderful affective moods. They can include things like storytelling, music, film, dance, etc. Often they consist of ritual or theatre, and they are designed to summon subjective affective experiences. So to make you feel different moods. And fairy festivals are particularly atmospheric. And the idea of a fairy festival itself is being a bordered in-between space that's in between solid earth and fairy land, which exists, according to our research participants, in a different dimension, is fascinating. And so these technologies and techniques are employed by the producers to really crystallize, materialize, and evoke the mood of fairyland.
And these can be quite transformative, I guess, experiences, given
Yes.
the liminality of the, the situation.
Yes. Often people perform rituals. For example, there was one festival where they all joined hands at a particularly liminal time of day, so evening or noon, and then they call to the earth and they summon. There are rituals, there's drumming, and so it can really have an uplifting and also invoke feelings of communitas, expression of ritual. So these events are absolutely fascinating from that perspective.
Yes. And you've also used a let's say, a not so common technique or analysis method. Can you explain a little bit about the interpretive phenomenological analysis that you used, and
Yes.
how you go about interpreting, the data or the observations before you?
Well, this is a really reflective methodology. So it was perfect for small sample analysis, and it allowed us to really delve into the phenomenological life world of our research participants. And this was quite complex because many of them were of the fairy faith themselves and had strong beliefs. And we felt very humbled actually by them sharing their beliefs with us in this context. I'm very protective of that. It's quite interesting as a researcher because you build up a relationship. And that's what this methodology is all about. It's called a form of double hermeneutics. So you've got the research participant reflecting on their experiences to quite a deep level. And then we also take each individual interview and reflect on that and then find these commonalities between them. But it's a way of, I'd say, taking it a little bit slower. You take it interview by interview by interview and go deep into the process. So it was a fabulous approach, actually. It's the first time I'd used it.
Okay.
And I felt that it took me closer to the ontology of the person who was involved and their world.
No, I was just going to say I like this. It's slow research. It's sort
Yes.
of countercultural in terms of pumping out papers, the publish or perish sort of mantra that's often that more is better. But he just taking it slow. Yeah. I mean, you're sharing the richness and the deepness and the connection that you've made with the participants, which I think is very good.
Well, it was quite extraordinary because and they really shared with us, and that does create a bond, which I think is perhaps not acknowledged enough in for us as researchers. Interestingly, this is I'm just going to go sideways now.
Sure.
I went to a conference about magic, and I was chatting to another researcher who was interviewing people who self-identified as witches. And both of us just said how much in awe we were of these people we were interviewing and how we cherished them for sharing this, what is a hidden world quite often, with us. Which really moves me on to the fact that I was so surprised that fairy beliefs and fairy festivals are pretty mainstream when you start looking. So it was amazing how these narratives, I think for many years, you couldn't admit you were a nerd, have now come out into the mainstream, and the tropes are everywhere. And in fact, places are becoming far more magical.
Right.
So it's almost a ripple effect.
Nice. So you touched a little bit on the results, but can you just return to them, and what were some of the key takeouts for the research?
Yes, of course. We talked to some quite substantial fantasy festivals and fairy festivals. And what we felt some of the conclusions were was that really what was very interesting is if you are conducting a mainstream event, so you've got everybody there from, as one of the participants described it, dads with big beards in tutus and their children walking along through to great costume designs that had took months and sometimes a year to parade and display, others who perhaps don't express this in the same way, who believe fervently. How do you bring this together in a more mainstream way to attract a lot of visitors? So one of the takeouts was that we found that sometimes some of the more challenging aspects, which one participant referred to as pagan with a capital P, were toned down a little bit. Now that's interesting because if you are perpetuating the idea of fairies, and some of the ideas of fairies from the past, well, they were pretty mischievous beings. You didn't actually want to encounter one because some of the results in terms of folklore were quite concerning, and these have been softened right down. So what's happening in the future to the iterations of fairies? Are we going to soften them down to make them more inclusive? And some of the programs like The Witcher actually take them to another extreme and make them more ecologically threatened, more diverse, etc. Some of this was also softened down as well. However, there's nothing wrong with a soft power. And one of the soft power attributes of these fairy festivals was their eco-friendly approaches. So that was really interesting. Another thing we found was that we're really interested, and I've researched for many years motifs. Folkloric motifs. And here they were, a go-go in this paper. You had wings, unicorns. The actual festivals were set in forests, by babbling brooks, by castles. You had the motifs, which are again perpetuated by the mainstream media in many fantasy programs now that millions of us can access globally. And these motifs, we found that there was an affective side to them. So obviously, affect with an A, so affective. And we felt this really hadn't been captured before, that they were transportative, that they were rich with atmosphere, and that there was a sort of fairy atmosphere that could be discussed as well, that incorporated this idea of magical thinking. So that was another takeout. Another one is that in our experience, magical and fantasy tourism can be undervalued and treated as superficial. So there is an assumption. I've researched enchantment before. I went along to a practitioner conference to talk about it, and they said, "Oh, when I started enchantment," I said, "No." So these events are quite disruptive in their own ways, and as you saw with the paper, we pulled it right back to anthropological theory. And what I had a shiver at one point because I felt like there were some really rich human rituals being performed in the modern day in this setting, and it was okay to do them in this setting. So perhaps a takeout would be that we underestimate magical tourism at our peril, really, because it's all pervasive today.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of overlaps with festival movement and different events
Yes.
about
Yep.
self seeking. It's related to wellness. It's about identity
Yes,
formation and yeah, I think there's lots of it touches on lots of different aspects of tourism and well, the human experience. Are you continuing this research, or
yes.
where do you see it going from here?
Well, Natasha and I are very excited. We have an upcoming conference presentation and session at the Association of American Geographers on magical tourism, which we're really looking forward to bringing out. And we have a book coming out on magical tourism. So, at any point, if Tourism Geographies is interested in a special issue, we're your academics. We'll get behind it. So we find that we are learning so much by doing this research and by talking to people that our view of what is possible in this domain is really opening up. So that's where we're taking it, further into the realm of the magical.
Excellent. Excellent. Like I said, when I saw you recently publish this, it piqued my interest, and I was very keen to talk to you and have you on the podcast. Is there anything else you'd like to add that you think we haven't covered?
No, I think we've gone through it all. I just, again, it was just so lovely to hear all the anecdotes that people told. I hope people read what the only thing I'd say is read the findings carefully because they are so lovely, those rich comments that people made. And perhaps to end with one of those comments, one of our participants said it was pouring with rain at Stoutwood, a festival, and everybody was feeling a little bit, down in the dumps. It was in May and they all had their umbrellas up. And this little girl was jumping up and down in a puddle and chanting, "I do, I do, I do believe in fairies. I do, I do, I do believe in fairies." And it spread through the whole festival. So the whole festival was dancing and jumping up and down and singing. I do believe in fairies. And it was so lovely to, you know, to encounter that and hear about that story. It's very visually evocative, that story. And I think that will always stay with me. So thank you again to our fabulous research participants.
Hey, it's been great talking to you. I just wanted to reiterate that I was talking to Jane Lovell. She's a reader at Canterbury Christchurch University in the UK, and she published with her colleague Natasha Sharma from the University of Alabama a paper called Fairy Tourism: Negotiating the Production of Fantasy Geographies and Magical Storyscapes. Jane, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me on the podcast. Lovely to meet you, Stephen.
Thank you for joining us on today's episode of the Tourism Geographies podcast. We hope you've enjoyed it and look forward to seeing you again on the next episode. Should you have any ideas, questions, or comments that you'd like to feed through to the production team of the Tourism Geographies podcast, please feel free to make contact with us. To find out more about Tourism Geographies, the journal, you can go to Google and type in Tourism Geographies, and soon enough you'll be directed to our journal website. Until next time, take care and safe travels.